Brought to you by BASF. We create chemistry.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
Welcome to the 100th edition of the Masters in Business podcast here on Bloomberg Radio. I am so thrilled and excited to have hit this milestone. If you would have told me when we began what really started as a Skunk Works project on the down low, a quick digression as to how this podcast came about. Tim O'Brien, who runs Bloomberg View and Bloomberg Gadfly, he's the one who set it up, was recruiting me to come right from Bloomberg. And I said, listen, you guys have a website. I have a website. Why do I want to publish for you guys instead of on my own site? And he said, well, look at this fantastic playground that we have here at Bloomberg. Look at the technology, the facilities. I have to tell you, that was really a very persuasive argument. The Bloomberg building, if you've never been, it's mind-blowing. It is a purpose-built technology and media high-rise in the middle of Midtown. It's really an amazing, amazing place. And if there's any way you could find the opportunity to come here professionally, you should. It's pretty awesome. And when Tim was showing me around the facilities, I noticed all these super cool radio booths and studios. Now, I've been to the Bloomberg building numerous times before. I've been on the radio here. I've been on the Bloomberg TV set. I've been here for conferences. So I'm somewhat familiar with the space. But when you're looking at it, not as just a guest who's blowing in and out in order to do a television show, but as a facility that someone says, hey, you have access to all of these really cool toys, you see it from a slightly different perspective. And so when we started chit-chatting about what we could actually do with these facilities, I started to get all sorts of interesting ideas. The first of which was, I would love to do a podcast and actually talk to some of the most intelligent and influential and important people in the industry, in business and finance on Wall Street. We kicked a few ideas around. Someone had suggested, how about a television show? I said, no, go get Joe Wiesenthal to do that. I don't want to do TV. I don't want to wear a suit and tie every day. I don't want to shave. I don't want to have to go on a diet. I've dropped about 20 pounds, but to do TV, I would have to drop another 20, and that would be a lot of work. So when they said, what do you want to do? My answer was, I want to sit with these people and have an adult conversation about important things. Well, podcast, what do you mean? And the elevator pitch was Mark Maron's WTF meets Charlie Rose. But I went back and looked at my notes, and my notes said, a podcast version of Jack Schwager's Market Wizards. And that was really the motivation for this show. And so who better to do our 100th podcast than the man, the legend himself, Jack Schwager? He is the author of numerous Market Wizards books. The first one is Market Wizards. The second one is New Market Wizards. The third one is Hedge Fund Wizards. Plus a number of different books on options and trading and futures. And, you know, he has been a trader his whole career, and the writing and editing started as a sort of side project, but obviously it blew up on its own. Another digression about Jack and I. So, I don't know, I'm a newbie in the industry. I'm around for less than 10 years. The first book anybody gives me to read when I'm studying for my Series 7 100 years ago was Market Wizards, and I just devoured it, and I was fascinated by the fact that all these different traders and fund managers in all these different fields, some were commodities, some were equities, some were bonds, some were more complex products, some were really simple strategies. There was a theme that ran through all of these interviews. And so not only did I devour the first book, but I reread it every 5 years. I find it to be absolutely fascinating. And the second time I read it, I want to say that was 99 or 2000 or something like that, I decided to do something I almost never do, which is write a review on Amazon.com for the book. And you'll see, other than whining about, you know, a poorly made product, I almost never do book reviews. I got stuff to do. I would rather read books than write book reviews. So I happened to be so moved by Market Wizards that I wrote a review of it. This was, I don't know, a 103, something like that. And posted on Amazon, completely forget about it. Fast forward to episode, I don't know, 15, 25, something like that. And Jack Schwager is one of our early guests. He was nice enough to come on. And he not only reminds me that I wrote a review of Market Wizards for Amazon, but yeah, Amazon does this sort of crowdsourcing thing where you could thumbs up or thumbs down a review. And it turned out that the readers of the Amazon page on Market Wizards had made that the top review of Market Wizards. Go to Amazon, click positive reviews. It's the first one. Jack says it's been the first one for over a decade. Who knew? Just one of those funny little ironies. 15 years ago, I wrote a review of a book that I thought was really, really interesting and important. And now, in 2016, it turns out that our 100th guest on Bloomberg Radio's Masters in Business show and podcast is the same gentleman, Jack Schwager. So with tremendous amount of excitement, I am thrilled to present our 100th podcast. Here he is, author and trader, Jack Schwager.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
I have a special guest today who is, should be, very well known if you are an investor or trader and like to read books about the craft. His name is Jack Schwager, and I have to tell you, the first book I ever received in the industry when I began was Market Wizards. I make it a point to reread it every 5 years or so. There are now three versions. There's Market Wizards, New Market Wizards, and Hedge Fund Wizards, as well as an audiobook of...
Actually, all of them are...
All three are now available
all
on audio.
Audiobooks.
Jack Schwager, welcome to Bloomberg.
Oh, thank you, Barry. Good to be here again.
So I really didn't give your background and introduction enough of a play-up. You're in addition to being an author, you're a trader. You've written a number of books on technical trading and futures trading along those lines, as well as an entrepreneur. I cannot underemphasize how influential Market Wizards was. When did the first book come out?
Market Wizards came out in 1989.
And how many copies has that, how many printings?
First of all, it's been translated in so many languages. I mean, weird language. I mean, languages I wouldn't normally expect, like Turkish and Croatian and Vietnamese and whatever, you know. So, and you have no idea. They sell these books. They make a contract, and you have no idea what it sells overseas.
Sure.
So, and China is like... There's two official language versions, not to count the bootleg versions.
Right. That's true of everything in China.
Yeah, but absolutely.
Whenever someone talks about China, there should be implied in parentheses, not to count the bootleg versions. That's a given. So, in other words, I would guess
between all the books I've written globally, I'd say probably a couple of million have sold. Yeah.
That's huge. And I, for those people who may not be familiar with Market Wizards, the premise of the book is essentially... let's speak to some very successful investors and traders and see how they do and what their secret sauce is. And what's fascinating, in the book, you spoke to people who are commodities traders, bond traders, equity traders, currency traders, and there were some really consistent themes no matter what these people were doing, whether they were long-term investors or the shortest of short-term traders. Certain themes came out in the book over and over again.
Right, and that was what I was trying to do. I was trying, what is the secret sauce? What separates this group of extremely successful?
Uber successful. Just off the charts.
Yeah, and some of them are, I mean, just extraordinary. And the people I've interviewed included sort of the most famous, you know, traders of modern times.
We're
going to
go into the specifics about some of them
in
a few minutes. But...
So as far as the lessons, I mean, there are tons of them, and I'm probably in the later books, when I did summaries, I might have had like, you know, 40 points, and if you had all the books, all the common denominators, I wouldn't be surprised if it got close to 100. So it's kind of hard to just say which ones, but the fact that they were radically different from each other was maybe one of the most important common denominators, because what it spoke to is they each found their own way. I mean, I can't tell you how many times people, you know, will ask me or write me, you know, say,
"What trader should I follow?"
That's right. What trader should I follow, or who's the best trader? You know, and you know, to me, that question has no answer, and the question actually makes no sense. It makes no more sense than somebody calling me and asking me, "I've got to go buy a suit. What size should I get?" And I've never seen the person. I mean, it's as relevant a question as that. So these people found what worked for them, and it was always different.
So let's talk about a couple of themes, though, that run through all the traders. Let's start with discipline, yeah. Probably the single most important lesson, at least that I took. What was the general take on being a disciplined person?
When I asked that question to a lot, you know, some questions I tried to do the interviews in conversational format, mm-hmm. you know, much like you do, right?
So we'll discuss. You were the inspiration for the show. That's absolutely true.
And, you know, don't start. I would have like questions sort of back up, you know, but I'd like talk, you know, and sometimes it'd go on, you know, we could have 2 days of conversation sometimes. And only at the end would I like, look, hey, did I miss anything? And usually nothing, you know, usually we picked mm-hmm. up everything. So I got off a tangent to where the original question was on discipline, right. So one question I did ask everybody, or just about, is what separates you? You know, what differentiates you? What why are you different? And discipline was the single most answer to that question.
That was the response.
That was the most common answer to that question was discipline.
Now let's dig in a little bit. When they say they're disciplined, are they referring to keeping their emotions in check? Are they referring to, I have a methodology and I follow it no matter what? What did they mean?
And those two are not separate. Yeah, but they mean primarily, I've got a methodology and I'm not going to stray from it. And I know you're a trader and I'm a trader, but anybody who's traded knows this, that if you got an approach that sort of works, and to be clear, no approach works any great amount of time.
Right. Everything falls in and out of favor. Everything cycles.
It's just a question of probabilities. But if you've got an approach that over time, probabilities are in your favor and you make more money than you lose and you keep control, if you've got that approach and you've got rules or trades that you do, and you'll lose on some of them, that's fine because you're going to lose on a certain percentage. But when you do stuff that is counter to what you're supposed to do, like, well, I got this is how I get into a trade. And then you look at the market. Gee, you know, let's take it. You know, we got Brexit going on here, you know, and you got this market crashing. Boy, this must be really oversold. It's not really part of my trade, but I'll take a flyer.
Right.
The pound's down 18 cents. You know, that's probably good for a bounce. I'll buy it. Those type of trades. So that's breaking discipline because that's not part of your plan. That's not part of your approach.
Unless your plan is randomly follow the headline of the news and chase everything.
Well.
But those people don't stay in business very long, do they?
Well, this is actually going. My example was just the opposite, sort of like you're gonna try to pick the bottom and you know, you're gonna try to catch the falling knife, so to speak. And some people could be a strategy. In fact, catching a falling knife, I've interviewed traders who do trade like that. But you have to have, but then you know where you're getting out. You know, you think it's going to hold here, and if it doesn't, you're out. So but just to blindly take a trade that's not part of your approach, that's where that would be breaking discipline. Or more important is not getting in. And I know I'm sort of preaching to the choir when I talk to you, but you know all of this stuff, and this is, I know you've got the exact same view. Getting in is the least important part. Getting out is what you got to worry about, and that's what people don't worry about.
I used to jokingly sell, there's a million books on what to buy, but other than Justin Mamis, what to sell,
nothing, right? Yeah, exactly.
On,
yeah.
Hey, here's your exit.
Right, exactly.
And that's where
the discipline comes in. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So let me back up and talk a little bit about you, because people may not be familiar with your background. So how did you find your way to finance?
Purely accidentally. I graduated, you know, from an Ivy League school.
Where'd you go to school?
Brown. I went to Brown. Mm-hmm. With a master's in economics, and I kind of expected sort of day after graduation, I'd sort of stick my head out, and I'd have 5 offers, you know, and all that.
Right.
And I didn't know how to look for a job in my first May. I mean, I had the temporary employment, but the first real job I was looking for. So I went to employment agencies, and They probably haven't changed since that time.
Yeah, they don't exist anymore.
Yeah, okay,
that's
whatever.
How they've
changed. Yeah, all right. So, but they weren't very effective. And like 2 weeks, I didn't hear back anything. So I got frustrated. So I just, at the time, the New York Times had a help, not a help wanted, but position wanted section. And so for about 16.
So as a job seeker,
yeah,
you could
job
post
seeker.
An ad.
So like, I think it cost me like $14 or $15. I put a two-line ad in and something along the line, master's in economics, minor in math, looking for an analytical job. Pretty much
that was it.
And I had about, 16, 17 responses to that.
Really?
All but one were come-ons. In other words,
people wanted to sell you something.
They want you to buy. It was like these chain sell.
Right.
They'll sell you $2,000 worth of soap bubbles, and you go find other people to sell it. That type of thing. I went to one of these thinking I was going to a meeting of the company, and that it was a manager. I said, I asked Stephen on the phone. This is not a sales. He said, we have sales, but this is, and I'm expecting to meet with this group at their quarterly meeting or whatever. And I walk in and there's like this huge auditorium and there's like a display in the front. And they have run a film with, I think it was Sebastian Cabot telling how great this product. And then they have a guy who is some sort of chemist who fell off a roof supposedly. And while he was in the hospital, was thinking how he can make his wife's job easier and sort of came up with this miracle cleaning product. And then they have a guy come out and tell you how he drives a Porsche and makes how you can make $10,000 in your spare time. Really, literally, this was it. So I went to one of these, obviously, and then any calls I got thereafter. But there was one legitimate call, mm-hmm. and that legitimate call, as fate would have it, was a research analyst position that was being vacated by Michael Marcus. Michael Marcus, who ultimately who was leaving to become a trader.
Mm-hmm.
And he ultimately became an incredible trader. We can talk more about him later if you want. But he and I met as he was leaving and I was going in. And sort of he still was in New York for a while and we would get together for lunches, every couple of weeks.
What firm was this?
This was a firm called, at the time, it was called Reynolds Securities, which mm-hmm. then merged into Dean Witter Reynolds and went into multiple. I don't
Prudential,
even know.
Ultimately it became UBS, well, or who did it?
I don't
end
know
up
where they ultimately ended up. I didn't stay. I stayed for 2 years. Mm-hmm. I started out like making $2,000 less than my secretary,
right?
who I shared with the research director, and was doing. I and another analyst were doing really almost all the work. And then after 2 years, I just stuck. And I was writing for the predecessor. Now it's called Modern Trading, and then before that it was called Futures, and before that mm-hmm. it was originally called Commodities Magazine.
I remember all those.
That's how I started writing. I started writing a column. I came so 2 years. I had a little bit of a reputation. I went. I stuck my head out. Instantaneously got a job. As a research director, triple that salary, and right. so I left at that. So I didn't stay at Reynolds too long.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Jack Schwager. He is the author of the famous Market Wizard series of books, as well as being a trader and entrepreneur. Let's talk a little bit about the role of luck and skill with traders, and I want to ask what is a deceptively simple question. How difficult is trading as a profession?
As to a profession where you can actually earn a living?
Yes.
Yeah, extremely, extremely difficult, and I don't think most people are cut out for it. In fact, I don't think I'm cut out for it.
Oh, really?
I've never wanted to. If I were really good, then I maybe would have entertained the idea of being a full-time trader, but I never was good enough, being good enough to be net profitable in the markets is very, very different from being good enough to your living coming from that. You're paying for right. your expenses. So I never had that particular confidence that I was good enough. And the only reason I'm even profitable as a trader is just because I've just spoken to so many people and I've had so much experience. I actually, my natural instincts are pretty poorly attuned for trading.
I think most people's
Most people's are, and I'm no exception. And in fact, some of the traits that are important for good trading, which something you asked before, one that comes up all the time is patience.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody like Jim Rogers has a great line. He says, I I don't do anything until there's money lying in a corner of the floor, and all I have to do is go and pick it up.
Right.
So yeah, you have patience just to wait for something that's like a real setup, you know, a real fat pitch. And similarly, to stay with a position, you know, the famous line from Reminiscences of a Stock Operator, which I like to paraphrase, but it might be the exact quote. He said, it was never... And for those listeners who don't know the book, it's a book.
Edward Lefauver's
book about Jesse Livermore, although Livermore is never identified. Everybody knows it's Livermore. And where the protagonist says, talking about what his success was due to, he says, it was never my thinking that made the money. It was my sitting. Got that? My sitting. So he said, hey, I'm not so smart. It's just I was able to stay and stay and stay with a position that was working out. So that all speaks to patience. And it's a trait that my wife is listening to this recording in the next room, and she probably would nod her head when I say, you don't want to be with me in the same car during a traffic jam. I am not a patient person.
That's interesting. There's a wonderful book, you know, given all the wonderful books on behavioral economics and how people's cognitive issues are so very suspect. Frank Portnoy, who's probably best known for writing the book Infectious Greed, wrote a book a few years ago called Wait. And it's a fascinating look at the psychology behind that exact thing, behind patience. And it really is a trait that can be learned. It's so important for both traders and investors. Just look, you mentioned Brexit and the crazy market. You know, I'm pretty confident that 20 years from now, when we look back, this is going to be a blip that we will have forgotten,
right?
Just like Ebola was forgotten, just like, yep. You know, Zika, I suspect, is the next one that makes huge headlines. And then 2 years later, it's like, oh, whatever happened to, you know, whatever happened to the chicken flu? Wasn't that a big thing that was coming along? And so anyway, let's talk a little bit about luck. How can somebody who's had a good run of trades identify the difference between trades that are based on skill and just getting lucky in their outcome?
Right. You can never identify any particular group of trades, whether you're just lucky or skillful. And there's always luck involved. But luck is the longer you go, the less luck will win out.
In other words, you can have a streak. You can have a hot streak for a while, and that could last for days, weeks, maybe even months.
Months, right.
But that's not going to go on for
forever,
years.
Forever, right, right. So
eventually skill wins
out. Yeah,
and
so if you're kind of almost, you know, most years, year in, year out, you're kind of that profitable, you never put your account into real danger by allowing a deep drawdown. And so if you're doing that, that's probably skill then, because luck alone, unless, I should make a proviso, you can have bull markets go on for multiple years. So if your approach is just to just go long and stay long, and you're doing well, and it's in a bull market, all you can assume is you've been long during a bull market. You have no idea what's going to happen when you have a bear market. So,
well, but there is some skill to being on the right side of
the
trade.
Well, it's fine, right? But if you've only been on one side in your trading, you know, people start trading, they start trading. Yeah, you know, how many people thought they were geniuses? They started trading in the 1990s,
right.
Yeah, right? So, but they continue trading through 2000 and 2001, thinking it was going to be the same thing. And so, yeah, they may have doubled their money, tripled their money, but then 190% drawdown takes care of all of that.
But that's the famous Buffett quote: "Is when the tide goes out, we find out who's been swimming naked."
Yeah, right.
And so that no doubt about that, you go through a full cycle. You find out if you actually are
skillful.
Yeah, so
that's the only
lucky proof.
You can't tell if anybody is good or not without really seeing them through a bear phase. And actually, just to criticize myself here, there was one. I have a fourth market wizard, a book called Stock Market Wizards, which I wrote right at the tail. It was right at the turn of late '99, so really at the end of the bull market. To make the book different from the other market wizard books, I took the theme just stock markets. I was interviewing only stock traders. So by definition, when I was doing the book, I was doing a book of only stock traders right after a long, long, and the bull market wasn't just the 90s.
Bull market, right?
82, yep. Right? We both know that. So, I thought I was taking people who, you know, also had the control, you know, who would do okay in a bear market and who would survive. But it turned out that, yeah, some of them did, but quite a few didn't. And so
So we never saw that book.
No, the book is out. The book is out. And some of the guy, you know, there are some famous people in there, like Dee Shaw and and well, controversial one, Stevie Cohen. But regardless of what,
guy's got an amazing track record.
Regardless,
of
you know, my thing about Stevie Cohen, I don't know anything more than anybody else knows. I read in the press and all of that. I know if there was anything really obvious, they would have certainly have loved to nail him, and they never did. So, but if people want to argue that he made, so, you know, he made insider trades, I don't know. I don't. Nobody.
Now
knows,
the question with him was there a lack of supervision over the people?
Yeah. Well, that's the question, right? Right. But even if you want, what I'm saying is, even if people want to say, hey, you know, these people work for him, he would have known, he was started. So, but this is a guy who does like, God, 30,000 trades a year. Who knows what?
He's half the volume of Sack.
And you look at his record. You could cut his record in half, and you still have one of the best records of all time.
Right.
So So what if a few trades? It doesn't make it.
It doesn't take away from him.
He is an incredible trader. No matter what anybody says.
So let me ask you one question that I've always found fascinating, and this has to be right in your sweet spot when you talk about skill and luck. And psychology, we all know traders who are like this. They take credit for all the winning trades, but there's always an excuse. They're always casting blame on any of the losses. What's that about?
If a trader does that, I'll give you 2-1 odds. They're gonna fail.
They're gonna blow up.
They're gonna fail. Anybody, and that's when I talk about trades. I mean, any decent trader will admit that it's his, you know, or her fault.
Who pulled the trigger? Whose fingers were on
the
keyboard?
And the bad luck comes into it all the time. I can't tell you how many times I get. Oh, the one for last week. It was like a cocoa trade, and I kind of picked my. And one of my types of trades is I like to buy markets counter trend, at spots where I think that they'll be sold out or bought out or whatever.
In other words, you have a good risk reward. Either
and I put a stop
out
right.
quickly,
and,
or you get a bounce the other
exactly.
way.
Exactly. And so my order rests there, and I have a stop that rests there. So one morning, I wake up and I look at the trades, and boy, I'm in and out of the cocoa trade. And this was the one day. It was like bizarre. It was the market that day. I didn't even know if there was any news, but it traded like about 20 times the range it normally trades. And I remember that one day, and it spiked down in 1 minute. I don't even know if there was any news. It spiked down a few hundred points in 1 minute. So here I get in, which would have been, I think, a great entry, but then like within 1 minute's time, I think, you know, within seconds, it like ticks down sort of like three ticks. You know, I had two stops, one is it like right almost at a low, 110, but like a second apart or whatever, and then it goes right back up again. Mm-hmm. So sure, you could say that's bad luck, and maybe, you know, that trade I think was bad luck, but that doesn't make a difference. The point is, over time, it shouldn't make any difference, because I'll have good luck too. You know, just the bad ones you really notice, the good ones you figure, the good ones you're smart on, the bad ones are bad luck, right?
In the old days, I would have blamed the specialist for robbing me. I don't know if we could do that. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Jack Schwager. He is the author of the Market Wizard series of books, as well as a number of books on futures trading and technical trading. He's also has been a trader for several decades. You know, the last time you were visiting us, you were just in the process of launching a company called Fundseeder, and you're using some technology to try to identify the new emerging traders that are coming up through the ranks. Tell us a little bit about how this works.
Sure. So the concept of Fundseeder is globally now, not just the U.S. or industrialized nations. There are just who knows how many hundreds of thousands or millions of traders. Now, most of them are not going to be any good. But you only need a tiny fraction of 1% that are good, and that's a realistic expectation. But they'll never be discovered. They might be in countries where there's no real place for
institutional infrastructure.
Exactly.
Nobody's
seeding
them.
You got a mathematician in Eastern Europe, let's say, right? Comes up with a great algorithm making money in the markets. Doesn't have much money to trade. Nobody will discover him. Nobody will speak to him. So, our idea was create a central spot on the web where traders could go get their track records verified on daily data. And by verified by, because the track records and numbers come not from the traders, but they come directly by linking their account.
From their custodians.
From the broker. So we're getting downloads direct. Well, of course, with the trader's authorization, we're getting downloads of the daily results. So
let me stop you right there. I know that when guys are launching hedge funds or any sort of proprietary trading operation, the first question that gets asked is, show me your audited returns. This really is a way to say, without spending tens of thousands of dollars on audits and without going through the whole process, which could be $30,000 or $50,000 or $100,000 to tee up a fund, this at least gives you a way to rank different traders on their at least recent performance.
Yeah, or actually, depending on what broker, it could be their entire performance. But it's not meant as a replacement for the audit, but it is meant as getting real numbers we believe are probably quite true.
It's an initial screen.
Yeah, it's an initial screening, right.
So before this, how would any of these people ever be found or seen?
They wouldn't. They wouldn't. And that's why, I think what is it like, something like 680 plus billion-dollar funds control sort of 88% of the, I think the number is like 88%.
I just saw that
right?
Not too long ago.
Very
fat head, long tail distribution.
Yeah, I mean, it's just super, and it gets more and more concentrated, it seems, over the years. So we live in a world where big money, all the institutional money goes to the same big traders, and everybody else is sort of left out of it.
Robert Frank calls this the winner-take-all society.
Yeah.
And it's true about movies, it's true about, you know, there's a handful of superstar musicians and then everybody else.
And we're trying
to
swim in the other direction.
Right.
Our thought is there's a lot of talent out there that just has no way of getting found. If we provide a venue where they can be found, discovered, then we can utilize that database to either introduce them to investors.
So that on one side is FundSeeder technology, is how you're screening for these people.
Well, yeah, and what FundSeeder technology, the main technology there is it's a platform for traders. Traders, first of all, it's linked. You know, traders can get their track records linked through the broker and get them verified daily record. But then it does nice, neat stuff, which like I as a trader would love to see a daily equity curve. It's something very difficult to get. I don't know if any brokers that have daily equity curves. And
Define what that is, because when I hear curve, I'm thinking yield curve.
No. So your equity day by day. You know, you take simply, you start off 100,000, you make 5,000, you got 105, you lose 7, you got 98. That track record over time, what does it look like? You know, so
hopefully up and to the right.
Right, but what are drawdowns?
When
are you starting to deviate from your normal pattern? What does it look like over time? We have all sorts of analytics on that. But just to solve the basic equity curve, just to be able to see how your equity is fluctuating over time itself is a really good, important thing to have.
So that's the find these obscure and unknown.
That's what they
managers.
Get. Well, that's what they create, and then they can do all sorts of analytics. They can create underwater curves, all sorts of stats, all sorts of studies, like what happens. Like you could apply moving averages, let's cross over moving average to your equity curve and say, what would have happened if every time there was the 10 and 40 moving average crossed down, I stopped trading and I didn't start until it crossed up? Questions like that. So that stuff is there and it's free.
So let's take the flip side of this. What is FundSeeder investor?
Okay, so we can't do any investment on that for compliance reasons, all that, you know. So we have a separate company called FundSeeder Investments, which will use the database created on FundSeeder Technologies, which is the FundSeeder.com site is FundSeeder Technologies, and we'll find the, you know, by ranking, by searching, we got search filters and all that, we'll find the best traders. Those traders that we believe have potential, we may have investors who are looking for certain types of traders, we can play the introductory role. Or one of our plans is hopefully by next year we'll have an emerging manager fund. And so we'll take a bunch of these guys and gals and put them into one fund and also create a fund. And this is important. Our plan right now is to create a fund that also is much fairer to investors, because as you being part of this industry know, it's, you know, it's heads I win, tails you lose, you know.
2 and 20, no, it's a giant drag on
I mean, it's like
else.
You can't, the trader, no matter what happens, always has a free call.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is author and trader Jack Schwager, author of the famous Market Wizards series of books. So let's go back to those three books or four books. And I wanted to ask, you mentioned the idea came to you because you really just wanted to chat with some traders and maybe learn some stuff. The response had to be really tremendous. Were you surprised at how well received the books became?
Yes, and but it always sounds a little bit kind of conceited. What I did when I wrote the book, and I mentioned like Reminiscences of a Stock Operator originally, right? I did have a goal of doing a modern day version, although my format's totally different. But I did the thing I had in mind is I was reading Reminiscences, which I thought was the best book on trading that I ever read. I was reading it 65 years after its publication date, right. And it was still totally relevant, even
right.
though the markets
still
have changed.
Today.
Yeah, that is today too, right? So my goal was to do a book that hopefully in 65 years from then, people would still be reading because it's still totally relevant. So that was my goal.
You had to feel like as you were working your way through it and re-editing it and rereading it, you had to be, hey, this stuff is pretty good.
I thought, and Tori, that the editing part is interesting and you maybe appreciate it. People sometimes think, one comment I get is, boy, you're a great interview, you're a great interviewer, you really ask great questions, and I say, no, I'm not a great interviewer. What I am is I'm a really great editor. Because I got I have like 10 or 20 times the material I actually use for the book. And not only that, a lot of times you have these, you get conversations, people go off in tangents, and it works well in this type of format, right? It's okay. You don't notice it because that's the way we speak. But in a written format, if I did verbatim of what everybody said,
choppy,
it would sound illiterate,
and
confusing, boring. Uh-huh. So my goal, and a journalist's goal is to be exactly word for word accurate. My goal was to be as accurate to the truth that I could. So if a trader was like going somewhere, didn't finish the point,
right.
And I knew what he was going to make the point, I would finish the point. But of course, let the traders read the end product. And they always
They actually reviewed it and said, I didn't put words in.
Well, they never
mouth.
Even knew I changed. I mean, they added things, what I was trying to do was get as close to what they were trying to say in a most readable form, throwing out the stuff that didn't have anything to say and that was boring and keeping the best parts and reshuffling it so it flowed. So uh-huh. You don't discuss the same thing in 18 different spots. But it was all, it was a combination of trying to be as true as possible to what they were communicating while making it as readable as possible. So trying to really serve both purposes. And that was what I was trying to do. And nobody ever thought that I had changed. I don't think they ever realized that. They probably thought it was verbatim because of what that's what I was trying to do.
It was pretty close to what it was what they hoped verbatim would have been.
Yeah.
So over the course of the four Market Wizards books, did you notice anything that had changed in the world, in the markets, or was it the focus just simply in a different aspect of
The world, the markets have changed. For one thing, I had like people who had floor trading experience and some of the most colorful stories in Market Wizards come. Like Paul Tudor Jones with the trade that almost blew him out of the business, where he puts on a trade way too large and it's in a cotton pit and the broker who almost kills himself trying to get to hit the opposite side of the order, is the broker for the merchant that owns all the deliverable supply, and Paul knows he's dead in the water, and he really almost completely wiped out on that trade. But stories like that, those couldn't happen anymore because the floors don't exist anymore. So
right.
Those things change. But the realities and what makes trading successful or not successful, those things haven't.
So last question before we get into some of the specific trades that are so fascinating. It has to be just tremendously gratifying to see how successful the books have come. Do you ever stop and say, I never in a million years expected this to happen?
Yeah, I guess I didn't think that far. I the fact that the original Market Wizards now is going on, 20... it was past 25th. It's so 8 years and 2 years. Well, it'd be 28 now. Something like 28 mm-hmm. years since I wrote it. So that is really was like the goal I was trying to reach. Am I surprised? I don't know. Didn't realize how difficult that should be. But it was what I was trying to achieve.
So let's talk about a few specific traders who I find to be fascinating. I want to pronounce his name
Sakota.
Right. Sakota.
Sakota.
So he says he doesn't publish his track record, but he was rumored to have started with $5,000 and turned it into tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah, so here's the thing with Sakota. And this is the thing. I try to verify people as much as I can in any ways you can, but sometimes you're dealing with people that are just private, not managing other people's money, that you're lucky to get them to interview. Now, Sakota, his name came up because I didn't know who he was. I had interviewed Michael Marcus, who I knew personally.
You mentioned Marcus
earlier. And just so people have context, we're talking about a guy that Commodities Corp, which used to be a different type of firm, but they were like a prop trading firm of futures traders. They gave Michael a $30,000 account, and about a dozen years later, that account was worth $80 million. And that was with them taking out like 20% a year for expenses.
Wow.
So the enormity of that track. He had a string of
Michael
years.
Michael Marcus.
Yeah, Michael Marcus had triple-digit returns for, he might have had a quadruple-digit. I mean, he had just astounding. He did astounding.
That, and this was all commodities.
This was all futures, and this was in the 70s and early 80s, and these markets were just. But he just knew how to exploit that type of market, and so he built a fortune in that period. But when I interviewed him, he said, you should speak. And he didn't want to do the interview because he's a very, very private person. He's never done another interview, as far as I know.
Really?
Nobody would have known who he is. He's very shy, very quiet. Very
no photos.
Doesn't give any talks. I don't think you'll find a photo of him. So that's Michael Marcus. And he agreed reluctantly and only through the intervention of a mutual friend to do the interview. And I flew out to Malibu to interview him, spent 2 days at his house. And the day we did the full interviews all over on the beach and walking and sitting and whatever.
Are you recording it? Are you taking notes?
Yeah, to recording it. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Everything. I had two recorders. I didn't take any chances. Anyway, at the end of dinner, which cooked by his in-house chef, and he pushes back the chair and he says, this wasn't half bad. This was kind of a cathartic experience. I kind of found it much
better. That strong praise from him.
Yeah.
Not half bad. Oh,
yeah,
really?
No.
That's terrific. So
he was the one who said, then you shouldn't interview Sakota, because Sakota is the best trader I know.
Really?
So this is a guy
coming from a rock star, he turns around and says,
Sakota. So I know Sakota's the real thing because I know this guy. I worked at Commodities Corp. I know he's real.
Right.
I know he did this amazing and Michael Marcus, not only that, Michael Marcus hired Kovner and was, Kovner worked with Marcus's protege. Kovner had his own style.
Which Kovner is this?
Bruce Kovner.
Bruce Kovner.
Caxton,
yep.
Mm-hmm. One of the greatest traders of modern times. So just to give you an idea, so somebody like Marcus is telling you about the best trader he knows,
that means something.
That's real.
What was it like with Sakota?
Oh, Sakota is a very odd character.
Yeah.
Very, very kind of eclectic, if you could use that as
sure.
a to describe
colorful.
Something. Colorful. He liked to phrase. He had a phrase for everything, mm-hmm. So I noticed, I was there and I said, hey, I noticed you don't have a quote machine on your desk. And he said, having a quote machine on your desk is like having a slot machine on your desk. You end up feeding it quarters all day. So his idea was he picks his trades. He did it systematically. He put them in. He doesn't want to watch. He doesn't want to be enticed by the market to do stuff that's outside of what the approach is. So
the noise in the background can be compelling and attractive. And he basically, so I'm going to assume no TVs in his office.
This is back in we did this in the 80s. Well, of course, they had TVs and stuff, but it wasn't as prevalent to have the big screens and all that.
How about Marty Schwartz?
Schwartz was he was very intense. Schwartz is a very intense guy. Schwartz, by the way, also had this people can't keep up records like this, but Schwartz, like a 10-year record, which he had audited. This is one of the times he was very proudly showed me his audited record.
Give us the numbers, because I know it. I want the audience.
Yeah, okay. It is, nobody's going to believe this. It's 25% a year.
25% a month.
A month.
For 10 years.
Yeah, 10 years.
Not 25% a year.
No, 25%.
25% a month for 10 consecutive
years. For 10 years.
With, also futures
with,
or?
Only stock index futures. He just traded stock index futures. And,
that's astonishing.
And he only had two or three losing months in the entire period. And I think his worst losing month was like a 3% loss. And he went out, and it was two. And he went out of his way to tell me that those were the months his kids were born, so he had distractions.
He was distracted. All right, that's fair enough. Those are some astonishing numbers. And let's do Stanley Druckenmiller.
Yeah, so Stanley Druckenmiller, again, one of the incredible traders of all time. I think people don't know how great he was. I mean, first of all, he ran his own Duquesne fund for close to 40 years and mm-hmm. Probably averaged around 30% compounded, trading billions of dollars. People also, a lot, unless they read my book, would not necessarily know that Druckenmiller ran the Soros' Quantum Fund for a long period when Soros was in Eastern Europe kind of doing other stuff that he was interested in doing. And so really an extraordinary trader.
So if people want to find out more information about either yourself or Fundseeder or Market Wizards, where's the best place for them to go?
Fundseeder.com. You know, mm-hmm. just Fundseeder is like one word and what it sounds like. And I have my own site, which I didn't do anything with, but you know, if you want to get the books or any other links to any stuff, jackschwager.com.
Jack, thank you so much for being so,
hey Barry,
so generous with
your
time. We've been speaking with Jack Schwager, author of Market Wizards. If you enjoy this conversation, be sure and stick around for the podcast extras where we keep the tape rolling and continue chatting. Be sure to check out my daily column on Bloomberg.com or follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Brought to you by BASF. We create chemistry.
Welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much, Jack. Thank you so much for doing this. You're one of our few repeat guests. And I know I've said this before, but I really have to reiterate, this show came about because of Market Wizards. It came about because I said, that looks like so much fun. When I first started writing for Bloomberg, they said, hey, we have these great facilities. It's a playground. What would you like to do? And my answer was, I want to find intelligent, accomplished people, both from in investing and outside, and sit them down and have a Market Wizards-like conversation. And they were, okay, go do that. That's really how this came about. So the last time we spoke, I would be remiss if I did not point this out. You reminded me of something fairly hilarious that I had forgotten about, which was the Amazon review of Market Wizards from 2003. So I actually went out and pulled that review today, and I just have to share this with the audience because it's so funny. I'm the market strategist for New York City Investment Bank, blah, blah, blah. Someone gave me this book when I first got into the industry a decade ago. So this is written in 2003. God, we are getting old. I find myself rereading it every 5 years. Quote, I highly recommend it to anyone who is involved in the markets. Simply stated, this is the book for anyone who wants to learn about trading or investing. It is simply a must read. What's so utterly compelling about the interviews is how consistent the themes are that arise from so many different traders. This is true regardless of the markets they work in, commodities, equities, currencies, bonds, or the style they employ. Technical, macroeconomic, fundamental, quantitative. The basic concepts revealed by the wizards are these: discipline, capital preservation, risk management, individual responsibility, flexibility, intellectual honesty, and consistency. Now, that's pretty fascinating.
And for the amount of words you use, you couldn't capture the book better.
I mean, that really is what the book had said to me, and I completely forgot about that.
Yeah, and that is reminded me. Yeah, but the thing is, your review, you know, how Amazon has, if you like a review, you know, this was helpful.
Reviews.
Yeah. And so that review, like, I don't know what it was, like, in, you know, 98 out of 99 people found it helpful or something like that. And it shows up as the top reviewed review.
And I completely, so it's the top ranked review of Market Wizards if you go to the page.
Yeah, it'll always be the first one, and nobody's ever going to replace that because.
So you reminded me of that, and I had no idea that was the case.
That's funny with it. You
the little ego things to go out and Google yourself or whatever. And by the way, I almost never, never write reviews of stuff. Usually it's because something is, this is not how it's advertised. This was advertised as a 12-pack and only one showed up or whatever it was. And I was moved enough by the book to write that review. And then I never thought a second.
And I'm sure it was very helpful. I mean, because when people go to that, and the first thing they see is your review, it's certainly
helped. It's sincere. It's honest. It's sincere. So So let's talk a little bit about some of the other wizards, because I think people are genuinely interested. During the broadcast portion, we didn't get to Richard Dennis. Tell us a little bit about Richard Dennis.
All right, Richard Dennis started out as a floor trader. He started on the Mid-America Exchange. Of course, we don't have any floors altogether, but the Mid-America, for people who are, unless they're old timers like us, the Mid-America Exchange was an exchange for people, for small mini contracts, so people who couldn't afford to trade the regular grain contracts, which weren't that big really, they would trade the Mid-America. And that's where he started out. And he started out literally, I think, about $200 and. You know, eventually got it up to a few thousand, but the little stake got multiplied ultimately to a couple hundred million dollars.
200 to a couple hundred million.
Yeah, 200 million plus whatever. I mean,
$200 to 200.
Oh, yeah, 200 million. Yeah.
Could be the greatest compounded return of all time.
There's quite a few. I mean, that would certainly be one of them for sure. Yeah. And now Dennis ultimately went on to manage money. That didn't work out so well. He did much better for his own money, and he started, blew out, you know, in fact, he got stuck in the big thing that hurt Dennis was, and that was also a bit of bad luck, I would say, was the 87 crash. Mm-hmm. Now everybody thinks of the 87 crash, of course, it was like the immense decline in the stock market. But what also happened in 87 crash was this amazing rally in the interest rate markets.
Sure.
And Eurodollars, which nowadays, you think of Eurodollars, they'll trade a cup, you know, they go 5 or 10 points, right? There was an overnight move of 250 points. I mean, think about that. That's like that's $2,500 per contract, you know, so it was like a $7,000 move roughly, I think it was, per contract. And we're talking a guy who's trading like, you know, thousands of contracts. And he couldn't do anything. It was like, it was instantaneous. It just like, it was a gap. You couldn't do anything.
No room.
So that trade, I think, pretty much wiped. You know, that killed his first one of his ventures. But he never again reached that.
What was he especially famous for?
He was a trend follower, and part of it, I think, maybe was like he operated when the markets were conducive to that. Now, trend following, we can get into this if you want. I mean, there's a reason why trend following works to some extent. All the time, over time.
There are elements of momentum and persistency that exist in all markets because people's mood tend to not flip-flop from day to day. If there's an expansionary period, it has a tendency to
But it's more fundamental than that. It's because the things that really drive the big moves are things that last. So it's a central bank decides to
secular trends.
They decide, well, we're going to weaken the dollar or strengthen the euro, whatever they're going to do, and they're not going to just do it for 2 days or 2 weeks. And these or there's a move to say, okay, we're going to start lowering interest rates. And usually when that happens, or raise interest, it makes no difference. Once that trend begins, it usually goes on. So trends have a way of persisting, and even if it's something like commodities or whatever, if there's a shortage of metals, it takes years to open new mines and stuff. So these trends can go on for a while.
Right.
So that's why it works. But it's gotten much more difficult to exploit because the markets, there's so many people who try to do this. When we were starting this early on, but the trader side, somebody Andres I interviewed, you know, they were the early ones doing this stuff, and they were doing trend following techniques. But now there's so many people doing it that you get a lot of false breakouts, and it's much more difficult to make money that way.
That's fascinating. So not only was he a big trend follower, but there's a famous story with him with the turtles.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, well, there's a group of traders called the Turtles, which where the name comes from, the story is that he was in Singapore and he saw a farm where they were raising turtles, a vat of turtles.
But
and
by the tens of thousands.
Thousands.
Then
his thought was, gee, wouldn't it be interesting if I could raise traders like they're raising turtles here.
Sort of like what you're trying to do with
Fun Cedar.
Which
is what we're trying with Fun Cedar, except we're not trying to train them or anything.
You're trying to spot them.
Yeah, and Dennis and another trader we talked about in intermission, Eckhart, who was his partner, trained this group of traders called the Turtles, and some of them went on to do quite well. And so that's a kind of a famous story. And they put an ad in
the Times.
Times, and
Wall Street Journal, was it?
Yeah. It was the Wall Street Journal, right? The Wall Street Journal, they did it 2 years. And they picked about 20 people each time.
With no previous Wall Street experience.
They were not looking for traders. They were looking for people like game inventors. They were looking for chess players. They were looking for people who kind of had creative and analytical and thing, but they didn't want people who actually knew anything about marketing. They don't want to be sullied by the wrong approach. You know, so
Renaissance Technology out in East Setauket near Stony Brook, Jim Simons, he doesn't hire Wall Street people.
That's a really deep quantitative stuff. So people like Simons, and Shore's similar, you know, they basically very highly quantitative approaches.
So those are some of the people you mentioned. Druckenmiller, we talked about Marty Schwartz. And any trader in particular you think worth mentioning that we haven't gotten to?
Yeah, the one trader we didn't talk about, who I just think is a phenomenal individual, is and probably in some ways of all the great people that I interviewed, is probably the most amazing. And that would
really?
Be that would be Ed Thorpe.
Sure. Beat the Dealer.
Beat the Dealer
was his first book, and then Beat the Market.
Beat the Markets, right.
He was out in Stanford or somewhere in California?
Yeah, he's out in California.
Is he still around?
He's still around. He's now, when I interviewed him, interviewed him in 2012. I think he was 78 or so, or 79.
Oh, okay.
So he's low 80s. Now, this is, you know, he's a mathematician, PhD mathematician.
Mm-hmm.
He actually, the way he became a PhD mathematician, which tells you a lot about the man, is he was doing his PhD. And this is a kid who grew up in the Depression,
mm-hmm.
In a poor school district with very bad education, taught himself physics at a young age, got accepted into, top universities in California.
Mm-hmm.
Was getting his PhD in, was working on his thesis and PhD in physics, decided he didn't have enough math knowledge, started the auditing courses and the graduate math courses, ended up with a PhD in math, never wrote his thesis. So he, you know, in physics, so technically speaking, he's not a PhD in physics, so he never bothered writing the thesis. But some of the stuff he did, he actually, and he has this amazing track record. His first fund, 19 years, he only had like two or three losing months in all those 19 years. 1% loss was the largest loss, 19% compounded. But that's a track record. He also did stuff like, the reason he did so well, he came up with the a mathematical equivalent formulation of the Black-Scholes model about 5 years before the famous paper that won the Nobel Prize. And he didn't publish it because, well, I asked him why, because he was too busy. Yeah, think of it. For 5 years, he may be the only person in the world who knows how to price options correctly.
That's a little bit, and
that's why that's where the
track
record comes
from. Was it
in
options?
He made it in every. He had the first warrant, you know, type option fund. He had the first convertible bond fund. He had the first stat op fund. He came up with all of these things on his own. Before his trading career, then he was doing stuff like he was the first person to with an MIT professor, Shannon, who was the father of information theory. They did the first miniature computer. This is back in the 60s. My God, you know, we had IBM mainframes as large as a room to do simple calculations. They created their own little miniature computer and did the studies to use Newtonian physics to beat the roulette wheel just to show that it could be done. And they got like a 44% edge on the roulette. And so he did all these amazing things.
That's fascinating. Why do you say he's the most interesting character?
Well, because he has all those elements. You know, he figured out how to beat, you know, the casinos at their own game. In fact, they had meetings about what to do about Thorpe. You know, about this math professor.
Really?
Yeah. And there's a story in.
Were they thinking about banning him from the casinos?
Well, worse than banning. Let's put it this way: one of the stories in Hedge Fund Market Wizards tells about, and this is like out of a movie. But his brakes not working, you know, going a downhill.
On the car
and just throwing the car in reverse and finding out that the car had been, you know, tampered with, you know.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So we had the...
Vegas is such a delightful place,
had some,
isn't it?
So he had that side of his life. And then he did all these... He was the creator of so many hedge fund strategies. He's the first guy to do it.
Mm-hmm.
There's all sorts of things. No, I can't even think. He was a Madoff. He knew Madoff. He figured out what Madoff was up to, like a dozen years before, and cool. he had investors because one of his investors said, "Hey, what do you think of this?" He said, "Give me the trades." And he, you know, he's
fraud.
A mathematician.
Clearly not.
He gave him 18 reasons why it was. Why it was. He said, "Get your money out."
Really?
Yep.
That's fascinating. It's a shame he didn't go public with that.
Yeah, I think I might have discussed that in the book, and there were reasons why, you know, he just felt that, you know, he couldn't get.
What are you going
to
do?
And of course, that, to be fair, you know, actually, I should know the name. The fellow who went public, Greek the, name,
Harry
Markopoulos. Markopoulos, right? I mean, he wrote this great paper. Which
no one believed it.
Beautiful analysis, and they ignored it.
I thought from Markopoulos' paper, the most compelling thing was, if he's doing this buy right strategy, there aren't enough options in the world
to cover
his trades.
Not only that.
This isn't complicated. He's got to be lying.
He's doing trades in markets that had no volume on that day. He's doing what? He's doing
tens of thousands. Millions of dollars, right. Yeah. And
tens of thousands of trades in a market that didn't even have any option
in
it.
It's hindsight bias is always present.
But that was foresight on Markopoulos' part.
Yeah,
and Thorpe's part, it was foresight.
That's quite fascinating. So let's talk a little bit about technicals, since you've written a book about trend following and market trading in futures. I shouldn't really call it trend following.
Yeah, it's really more
technically oriented.
The book that got me into this whole thing writing was an analytical book called The Complete Guide to the Futures Market, 1984, which was the catalyst for the Market Wizard books, because that book, I told you I had the idea years before. That book did well for an analytical book. I had some publishers say, hey, why don't you do a whole bunch of analytical books? I said, no, thank you. I've done that once.
This was a lot of work. Yeah.
And so I did The Market Wizards. But that book is now getting redone. I have a co-author, Mark Etzko, and is doing a great job, doing great legwork, getting it updated. And so that the updated version, the new version of The Complete Guide to the Market, Complete Guide to the Futures Market. It's The Complete Guide to Futures Market, which is fundamentals, technical options, et cetera, trading. That comes out this fall sometime.
Oh, that's interesting. So how did you find your way to technicals? What made you look?
So I see. So you're looking at somebody who started out as a fundamental analyst.
I hear this on a regular basis. Yep, guy starts out as a CFA or a macroeconomist, and then wanders his way into
charts. I come from what's my education? I've got a degree in economics, so. So you're going to be inclined to look for statistical, analytic, you know, that type of analysis approach. But I found that the fundamental analysis was very poorly attuned to trading, because fundamentals don't give you timing. And it's worse than, actually, I say the only way that fundamentals are useful for timing is in a contrarian way. So in other words, if you have something that's supposed to be bullish for the market – and it doesn't cause the market to go up much, or as much as you think, or cause the market goes down, that might be useful bearish information. But used as the way it's intended, fundamentals do not work for timing, because they're just too broad. They're much too broad.
Ralph Acampora, I think, had the greatest explanation on the tension between fundamentals and technicals. I actually have a quote of his. Fundamentals tell you what to buy. Technicals tell you when.
Yeah, that's a good way to do it. And you can use fundamentals of that. You can say, well, yeah, and if you're a good fundamental analyst, you can say, well, this market should go up over time. I want to look for only buy trade. That's a good use of fundamentals. And the way I got into technicals is because I was a research director, and one of my analysts was a technical analyst. I didn't do anything. But I noticed that of all the analysts, he was the only one who was doing well, right? Mm-hmm. And so I like to think I was a little bit open-minded. So I said, Steve, you know, tell me what you do. And he started, you know, and
Steve, Steve who? Which?
Oh, okay. So I should. Yeah, absolutely. Steve Kronowitz. And unfortunately, Steve Kronowitz he was a very close friend. And he unfortunately died just a couple of months ago. So it was, you know, probably the worst loss I had as a friend in my life.
Really?
He was a great person. But Steve was the one who taught me technical analysis.
When you said, tell me what you do, how does he answer
that? So he said, you know, well, he made me understand why these things work. You know, so I came in with how could this stuff work? And they appreciate that it works because it reflects everything going in the market. It's reflecting the psychology of what you're seeing. You're seeing fundamentals in the charts. Mm-hmm. It's just you're seeing them through the price action.
Right.
And that's what the people don't understand. That. People say, oh, it's a bunch of mumbo jumbo and all that. Well, no, because anything that people who are moving the markets for fundamentals, they can't hide what they're doing. It shows up in the
supply
price.
Supply and demand.
It shows up in the price.
So that leads to a question I had written down to ask you. What do you think people misunderstand about technicals?
That's a key thing, that the technicals aren't some mysterious thing. They are the reflection of all the participants in the market. So they do reflect fundamentals. Another thing, and this is one of the main things the complete guide to the futures market, one of my main points is, and I go through lots of chart analysis, technical analysis, all that, I say, it's not so much interpreting when these patterns, and it's a lot of subjectivity. What's even more important is when things that should work one way based upon the technical analysis don't work. So what I call a sort of a failed signal is more important than a classical signal.
Tells you something is happening.
Yeah, so if you get a market, hey, this was actually...
My favorite example is, this is really terrible news, and the stock actually rallied on
that's right. That's a type of thing. But I'll give you like one example that personally, it was a week or two ago. I was long the bonds, and the market was going up, and then one morning it gaps into highs. I'm doing great, right? And it's sort of, and then during the day it just goes down, starts going down and down and down and down. And I say, hey, that is just not the right type of action. And I had stops in, so if it got close to unchanged, I'd be out. I got out. And yeah, now with Brexit, it's going back up again, but it had a good size reaction. And that's a good example of, you had a gap breakout, it should have been strong, and it failed. It came back into, so that's again. So to me, that's a much better signal than the breakout.
So today we're sitting in this room with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, like 10 monitors and, five computers hooked up to a network of industrial military grade computing technology. What has all of this computing horsepower and all of this charting software done to the world of technicals? And I say that with the admission that I came up with guys who would do charts by hand every night.
And this traders, there are traders who I interviewed who still insist on, doing it by hand. And as far as I go, for example, I don't use any of the indicators. I just look at charts. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm more comfortable with that. And my attitude is, in fact, all these indicators are just derivatives of price anyway.
Right.
Yeah. So, and my
moving averages and oscillators and all those.
Yeah,
different-
they're just formulations of price. So you're really not getting anything more than price. You're just getting it in a different type of picture. And my analogy for that is, it's you take something like sunglasses, and some people are like an amber color better, something like a bluish color better. It's a personal taste. And some people one color work better for other people. It's a matter of personal taste. So in my case, I just like the plain charts, plain vanilla, clear.
But you're not an Elliott Wave guy. You're not a DeMarc person.
I'm not,
you're not
Elliot,
a GAN analyst or Fibonacci. Or
my approach, and again, I'm not a great trader, but my approach basically is just look at the charts, form an opinion. Could be trend following type trade. Could be counter trend. But either way, it's got some sort of reason off the charts why I'm looking at it that way. And in every case, I'm putting in a stop along with the entry.
Let me ask you a slightly different question. Does all this charting software that's out there, so anyone could have access to an immense amount of technical analysis that really wasn't all that available when I was starting.
Yeah.
What has that done to the world of trading, if anything?
I don't know. Yeah, I think for some people, they learn to use some of those indicators in certain ways that work for them. And so it gives them, there's much more variety. And insofar as people need to find a way that works for them, it makes it possible, just multiplies tremendously the amount of ways people can trade the market. So I guess in that way, it's probably useful. But no matter back then and now, there's only going to be a smaller number of people that will excel in the markets.
All right, so I know I only have you for a few minutes longer. Let me get to my list of favored questions and start plowing into this. Let's jump right in with the mentors. So you mentioned...
My mentors. Yeah, so the one mentor, I really would say I have one mentor, and that mentor would be Steve Kronowitz, because he's a fellow who taught me classical chart analysis. I never read the classical chart books and everything else.
No McGee and
yeah, McGee, which is not a, I just ended up not, I because I learned the basic things from Steve, and then from following the markets, I find everybody, if you look at charts, you get your own biases, certain things. And I'll mention another fellow who's a close friend, Peter Brandt.
Sure. I know Pete. Absolutely.
And not that he's a friend.
By the way, Pete is pretty well known on Twitter, and I know a lot of traders who follow him.
Yeah. So, Pete, not that he's a mentor, because he is. He and I are very similar in the type of approach. I mean, we may not look at the chart and get the same opinion sometimes, yes, sometimes no. That's not where we're similar, but it's the same type of thought that you know you're only going to win a certain percentage of your time. You always know your risk point. It's much more important to keep your losses controlled and be unemotional and just use the information. Don't try to make the markets work. You know, do what you want them to do. Just follow what the markets are telling you. And it's a lot of similar philosophy.
So not necessarily a mentor question, but what other of all the traders and investors we mentioned, who influenced you philosophically? Well, it sounds like Brandt and you were very simpatico, but in the formative days.
But yeah, in the formative days, I would say of all, there are a number of people who made the same point, but as a line that sticks in my mind, maybe the single most important sentence that anybody uttered, you know. Okay, that's something to get people
my attention,
to, right?
Yeah.
Right? Is Bruce Kovner's line is always know where you're going to get out before you get in.
I started on a desk with the head of the desk was a Marine jungle combat instructor. So he's a big badass guy, and you know he had the same exact line, but he would always couch it in Marine terms. He said, before you take, you're going to take a village, you're going to take a house, you're going to take a hill. You have to know we're getting in, we're getting out, but we have to know what's our exit. And if that exit is blocked, what's our plan B and what's our plan C?
Right.
You always have, if you want to get out alive, you have to know what your exit strategy is and what the alternatives are if something mucks up that
perfect
first
analogy,
strategy.
Yeah.
And that sounds very much like what Kovner said. Only that's got a little more mud and teeth in it.
Well, the one thing I would add to that is also that the key about it is that what he's really saying there is, do it before you get in because that's when you still have objectivity.
You're objective, you're not emotional.
Right.
Your
analogy works. Don't do it in the heat of combat. Do it when you're planning it. Right.
That's exactly right. That's always, my analogy is, you know that card in the seat back in front of you? While you're on the ground, that's when you want to read it and see where
exits are.
Right, where are the exits? Where's the flotation devices? Not, oh, look, the wing is on fire, which was on the news today. At 30,000 feet, probably not the time where you're going to have the presence of mind to learn anything from that. So let's talk a little bit about books. We've been talking about your books.
Yep.
What other books have you read? Fiction, nonfiction, investing,
sure.
What other books have you found to be... hey, people should read this.
Okay. I'd recommend as authors for entertaining purposes, you know, anything Michael Lewis has written is just superb.
100%.
I think Michael Lewis is one of the great authors of all time. I mean, just tremendously entertaining. But also a brilliant talent. You take a book like The Big Short, and I can appreciate this because I wrote in Hedge Fund Market Wizards. I had to cover some of the same territory. To take the complexity of what went on there and to make it entertaining and understandable is a talent. So anything
and
Lewis,
he consistently finds these angles to bring and these personalities to tell the story, just wonderful. I will admit I have never read one of his books. I've read all of his books except one is the accurate way to say it. And I'm saving The Blind Side for my next vacation.
Oh, great.
Because I always read his books and I will plow through them in a day.
Yeah,
The Big Short, a day.
They're great.
Flash Boys, a day. Moneyball, a day. You sit on the beach. It's like, wow.
Yeah. It's entertaining. You learn stuff. It's insightful. It's creative. Yeah. So another author I would put very high up and whose influence I think will stay for a long time is Nassim Taleb.
Mm-hmm.
I guess Black Swan is probably his most famous book, personally.
Fooled by Randomness, I think is probably more famous and more useful.
Well,
quite
personally, Fooled by Randomness, and Taleb would not agree with me, because I think he thinks Black Swan is his best book. I think, I'm not sure. But I think Fooled by Randomness is not just because it was the first of those type of books, but it really got all the key lessons, and it so much captured how a lot of what people think is skill is really luck and confuse the two, and also not appreciate the fact that there are the tail nature of events in the markets, as and that and so all those themes really come out very well.
It's a shame that he's not going to hear this interview, because I retweeted something somebody else had written, and he was so angry at that person that not only did he block them on Twitter, but he blocked me. Oh, I know who it was Noah Smith, who's a fabulous writer.
Let me give a caduceus here. Noah Smith, who's a economist blogger, and Talib, I know, hates him. but Noah Smith is, for a guy who writes short, succinct articles on economics that are pertinent, they're just extremely well explained. He's not a liberal. He's not a conservative. That's what I love
data
about him.
Data-based guy. Let me share a little inside baseball with you about Noah Smith. So I'm the guy who brought Noah Smith to Bloomberg View. How do I know Noah Smith? So he comes, listen to his background. It's really fascinating. I think he comes out of Berkeley with a degree in physics. Then he goes to Michigan, University of Michigan, to get his PhD in economics. Then he's teaching at my alma mater, State University of New York at Stony Brook, in the economics department. I've spoken to his class a couple of times. And when Bloomberg View was coming together, I every now and then would say, hey, are you looking for a guy to cover this or that? Yeah, send a name. So a number of people I referred them to ultimately became writers here. I always loved, for the same reasons that you do, Noah Smith's work. He's a fascinating guy. Then add to that, just absolutely brilliant, smart as a whip. Add to that, P.S., he speaks fluent Japanese and spends summers in Japan every year for the past decade. This is really an interesting, unusual, talk about eclectic, physics, economics, Japanese.
But he writes very clearly.
Very understandable, takes really complex issues and makes it readily accessible. From what I followed with him and Taleb, he used the concept of a black swan, apparently in a way that Taleb was not happy about. Now, last I checked, Taleb doesn't have the trademark on a black swan, meaning we were expecting this and we got something else. Oh, and by the way, it was a tail event. It was a low probability but significant outcome event. I think the two of them used the phrase slightly differently. And look, I have no beef with Taleb, and I love Noah Smith's work. He went so postal at him. Taleb went so postal at Smith for writing this. He was so angry at me merely for retweeting it.
Wow, yeah.
He goes, I just can't countenance you retweeting this, and I have to block you. So,
and we should tell people for Noah Smith, his blog is called Noah Opinion.
It's the word Noah and opinion combined, sort of a... I forgot the word of what that's called when you combine. It's on the tip of my tongue. I don't have an issue with Taleb. I find his work to be fascinating. I don't think what he does on Twitter is a good look.
Crushing
it, getting into fights with people all the time. But I understand it. Listen, we all have a certain amount of road rage that's tough to keep tamped down.
Taleb doesn't suffer
another
fools.
Another fascinating guy.
Doesn't suffer fools easily.
But Noah is no fool.
Exactly.
That's the thing.
But I think sometimes maybe he may confuse, who the fools are, So.
That's exactly. Listen, over the weekend following Brexit, I saw a data point that said, you look at how the older folks voted. They voted overwhelmingly to leave. And you look at how the younger folks voted, and they voted overwhelmingly to stay. And I tweeted this data point out that had come from one of the UK papers. And someone tweeted the line with there's a British soldier saluting in a huge cemetery. And they tweeted, what did the old folks ever do for the UK? And I had to call the guy out. Yeah. I'm like, well, if you're 80 and you voted for Brexit, that's fantastic. You were 3 years old when World War II started. So please do some basic math and stop lying about this. You already won, but you don't have to. You could stop lying now that you won. You don't have to. And I felt myself wanting to go full Taleb, Nassim on the guy. Yeah. But there's a difference between calling out someone who's intellectually dishonest, someone who's a liar, not suffering fools gladly.
Yeah, and I was very surprised when I saw there was some, you know, comments that he was making. I didn't really read the whole thing.
But, Nassim, come back. Unblock Barry and Noah. Yeah. We miss you. We love you. And be less of a... By the way, he's another guy that I would love to have on the show.
I'm afraid
he'll just chew the furniture. He's you know, I've met him. I've had lunch with him. Yeah. I think he's an interesting guy. He's certainly smart enough. Maybe it's a generational thing. Well, I got enough of a foot in the under 50.
Well, ask him. Ask him. You know,
I'd ask him on Twitter, but I'm blocked. But all right, let's not have this
belabor
digression.
That, yeah.
Let's go back to what other books besides Michael Lewis and Nassim Taleb? Other books do you find
interesting? Well, I mentioned Reminiscence of a Stock Operator.
Classic, all-time classic. Beat the Dealer, Beat the Market.
My favorite book, my personal favorite book of all time, one of the only books I've read several times, is a book called Endurance about Shackleton's...
Endurance.
So his original book, there have been several books about Shackleton, that the Antarctic
event. There's a movie out now.
Yeah, there's movies and stuff, I think. Well, there have been. But that first book, I think it was by Lansing, which was written, I think it was written in 1955, but it is the most compelling story.
Tell the Shackleton story.
So the Shackleton story, an Antarctic expedition, bottom line, gets stuck, trapped in the ice. In middle life, they just have nothing. And they should have been, they hunted to some extent, but they couldn't be rescued for years. But I almost don't want to say what happened or what happened to a survival.
But it's worth reading.
Because you don't know. If you don't know, it makes it much more interesting. But as a tale of survival, it is, if it's not the best tale of survival ever written, it's human endurance. I mean, the book is well titled, and there are so many images in there, and the story itself is so compelling. It's just a great read.
I'll put that on my list. That sounds fascinating. So since you joined the finance industry, what are some of the most significant changes that you've witnessed?
Well, we talked about the floors disappearing, tremendous, the computers. I mean, the whole, I started out in a day where we didn't even have quote machine, on the desk. We had these giant wall boards with the click, and that was technology, the wall boards, which, clicked every time the price changed. So technology has been a tremendous change, and that's brought into existence a whole bunch of the approaches that would have been impossible because of the calculations involved. They're just too intense to do any other way. So it's changed the nature of trading in that sense. I guess a lot more strategies. I mean, it used to be much simpler. You got 58 different hedge fund strategies now, all sorts of arcane stuff. So those are some of the changes, but human nature doesn't change, and that's where the similarity of markets remains.
So given the technology changes in the past, what do you think might be some of the next major shifts we see going forward?
See, I'm not a predictor. I don't know.
That's the right answer.
Yeah, I don't know.
I always like that answer. If you don't know, you're better off saying that than guessing. And so few people in this industry are willing to say.
Yeah, I never answer a question like that. Yeah, I don't think I know the answer to.
By the way, I've done enough TV in my career that when someone asks you a question and you say I don't know, it throws them off. They have no idea what to do.
Yeah, yeah.
I've done that a couple. So where's the Dow going to be?
Right.
I don't know. They look at you like you have two heads. Come on, give me a number. 7.
I remember doing an interview in Australia, and I said, look, I can talk about trading, I can talk about this, I can talk about that. But he said, "Don't ask me.
I'm not Nostradamus."
And I said, "I'm not following the Australia." The first question: what do you think the Australian stock market's going to do?
I have no idea.
Yeah, and that's basically what I answered.
So let's get to our two favorite questions that we ask all of our guests. So a millennial or recent graduate comes to you and says, "I'm thinking of getting into finance as a career. What sort of advice would you give them?"
Oh, that's a tough one. you're talking about trading or talking just finance? First make sure it's what you really want to do. I mean, you're not just looking to do it for the money. I guess in terms of finding a job, probably the only effective way to do it these days is networking.
Mm-hmm. Try to write. What about the career itself?
the tree has to be geared to something that, well, you want to go for your strength. So if you can write, you want to try to find an angle that emphasizes writing. If you can do analytics, you know, do that. If you're good in computers, you know, so take advantage of your strength and try to break into the career on your strong point, basically.
Focus on your strong point. And our last question, what is it that you know about investing today you wish you knew 30 plus years ago when you started?
Well, one of the themes of Market Wizards is that the risk management is more important than trading strategy. You know what? And this is one I've made mistake I made more recently, and I wish I learned much quicker. And even if I learned it, I kind of repeated it. Hopefully, I'll never repeat it again. But my biggest flaw as a trader is be careful of getting too complacent when you're doing very well. So all my, you know, for years and years, every time I've had any significant drawdowns, it's always been after I've done extremely well.
No, that I've witnessed that and experienced it personally.
So I'm actually superb at coming in with a small stake and either just controlling the loss to a tiny amount or not losing anything and just getting ahead and never being behind. I'm really, really good at that. But I'm really been terrible about once I get ahead, not a lot, you know, then giving back a chunk, which I would, but because I do things or take more risk or do things differently than I would have done when I was being so super cautious. So when I start out in the beginning, I don't trade all the time. So it depends on how busy I am. But every time I start trading, I start very small and very cautious, and that's when I'm best.
So it's so funny you say that. When I began as a trader, I ended up creating a number of rules, one of which was never let a profit turn into a loss. But then mid-90s, just like you talked, what happens when you have these giant winners? So that's where the 25% rule came from, which is when you're up X percent and X has to be substantial, if you give back 25%, that's it. Cut your losses and move
on.
I
think that's a good loss.
And there's something along there. So in other words, you're up 100, up now I'm only up 75. That's it. I'm out. Otherwise, we've all seen those round trips too many times. Yep. Jack, this has been absolutely fascinating.
Always
thank
have
you
fun
so much,
with you, Barry.
Thank you so
that's
much
great.
For doing this. For those of you who are still with us almost 2 hours later, we've been speaking with Jack Schwager. He is the author of The Complete Guide to Futures Trading. Look for the new edition coming out in the fall. Market Wizards, Stock Market Wizards, New Market Wizards, and Hedge Fund Wizards, as well as The Little Book of Market Wizards.
Well, you got them all there.
Did I nailed them all. And be sure and check out Jack's new entrepreneurial venture, funseeder.com, where you could see how they are trying to find the new emerging managers. Perhaps if you're an active trader, you might want to register at Funseeder and see if eventually they find you as one of the outstanding performers. If you have enjoyed this conversation, be sure and look up an inch or down an inch on Apple iTunes and see any of the other 97 or so such chats that we've had. Check out my daily column on Bloomberg.com, or you can follow me on Twitter. Are you on Twitter these days, Jack?
Yeah, I am. Jack Schwager,
At Jack Schwager. I would be remiss if I did not thank Taylor Riggs, my booker, Charlie Vollmer, our producer, and Reggie, our recording engineer. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Brought to you by BASF. We create chemistry.